At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The prudent investor will, from time to time, look beyond the headlines, past that profit report or earnings outlook, and ask more substantive questions. Like, what do you mean you've got billions in loans gone bad? Or, are you kidding you're still tied up in the subprime mess? Wall Street banks took a beating today, even when they were making money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, California, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It's the 20th of July today. Glad to have you with us. It's tempting. We know that. You hear the earnings statement and you say, oh, that's pretty good, or wow, they lost how much? It's called the number, and on it can ride huge swings in share value. But the fact of the matter is that it's a trick, a misdirection, because the things you really need to know take some digging. Big banks are a good case in point. Citigroup reported second quarter earnings today, up 18%. Wachovia celebrated a 24% jump in profits. Yesterday, we heard bullish news from Bank of America and SunTrust. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports a closer look shows some cracks in the system.
Citigroup, Bank of America, Washington Mutual, JP Morgan Chase, all of these banks said this week they've had to set aside more money to cover losses from things like mortgage delinquencies and unpaid credit card bills. Soaring trading profits and investment banking fees have compensated for the big banks' losses, but analyst Frank Braden with Standard & Poor's says smaller banks are feeling the pinch. Profits at Columbus, Ohio-based Huntington Bank are down 28% from this time last year.
Several years ago, these companies took the opportunity to get in on the mortgage business and reap the rewards of that. And now, because they don't have the diversified revenue base, you know, a company like JP Morgan and Citigroup has, they're getting hit the hardest and don't have any place to hide from that.
The big banks won't escape unscathed. Some of them have also invested in complicated bonds that are backed by subprime mortgages. In the past few weeks, many of these securities have turned out to be worth far less than people thought. Christopher Whalen follows banks for the research firm Institutional Risk Analytics. He says the industry as a whole is in for a rough ride.
You're going to have a lot of banks caught in between two immovable objects. One is the rising cost of dealing with delinquencies. And on the other hand, they're not going to have a lot of great growth opportunities the way they did with the mortgage boom.
Investors seem worried enough about credit losses to overlook Citigroup's and Wachovia's overall profits. Shares in both banks fell today. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It wasn't all banks gone bad today. Technology takes its share of the blame. You ought to think Google when you hear that. They had a sour earnings statement yesterday right after the bell. Let's get back, though, to something Amy was telling us about, how banks are still trying to sort their way through the subprime mortgage debacle. The most recent example is Bear Stearns. We mentioned Wednesday it told investors in two of its high-profile hedge funds their money's essentially gone, all $1.5 billion of it right down the subprime drain. As might have been expected, it didn't take but 48 hours for threats of lawsuits to start flying. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now from New York.
Earlier this week, Bear Stearns said there was effectively no value left in one hedge fund and very little value left in the other. Some investors may be trying to work out what the difference is. Others are starting to ask questions like, are there grounds for a lawsuit? Jake Szymanski is one of several lawyers who says he's been retained to look into it. His clients want to know if Bear Stearns misled them about the risk of putting money into those funds.
If there was improper disclosure, whether you're rich or poor, there may have been a violation of securities laws. Investors are entitled to honest information. If that was not provided, then Bear Stearns has a problem.
Investors shoveled $1.5 billion into those Bear Stearns funds. With so much money at stake, there's potential for a slew of lawsuits. But Janet Tavakoli, head of research firm Tavakoli Structured Finance, says litigation could be a hard sell. She says these investors were highly sophisticated. They included other Wall Street firms, which almost certainly knew the risks involved.
There is a tendency to cry over spilt milk.
But that doesn't mean they have to take big losses lying down, she says.
It is reasonable to ask questions like, you know, in a market when it seemed that everyone was concerned about the value of subprime assets, why didn't we see the prices falling sooner? And would I have had an earlier opportunity to recover more of my money?
Investors may now be questioning their exposure elsewhere, wondering what'll happen if the subprime market keeps falling and taking other hedge funds with it. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Just for a change, here's a little trivia to see if all of that college tuition you and your parents paid went to good use. Where does this piece of financial advice come from? Neither a borrower nor a lender be. 10 points to those who answered Shakespeare, Hamlet to be precise. That's the bonus part of the question. On Capitol Hill today, the lenders weren't looking so good. In the wee hours of the morning, the Senate passed the Higher Education Access Act. It's a big piece of legislation that would cut about $18 billion in federal subsidies to companies that make student loans. Instead, the money's going to be used to fund grants and student aid. And if it's approved by the president, it's going to make that whole being a borrower thing a lot easier. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
Senator Edward Kennedy called the passage a victory for students and their families. Big lenders like Nelnet don't see it that way at all. Here's spokesman Eric Solomon.
Essentially, the legislation is going to force a significant portion of the private sector away from the student loan market.
Lenders say it just wouldn't be worth it if their profits dwindled to 0.1% on federal loans. Those loans, by the way, make up about a third of all student financial aid. Kevin Bruns, who runs the lenders group America's Student Loan Providers, says borrower benefits like reduced interest rates will be the first thing to go.
You can't cut $18 billion out of a federal student loan program and not have that passed on to the ultimate consumer. I mean, it defies law of economics.
Lenders have said that every time an attempt has been made to reduce their profits.
That's Barmak Nasirian at the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers. He calls the bill a giant step in the right direction. The bill would boost Pell Grants from an annual maximum of $4,300 to $5,400. There would also be a cap on how much of a borrower's income could be used to repay loans, and student debt would be forgiven after about 20 years.
The House bill and the Senate bill actually focus back on who the intended beneficiary was supposed to be, namely students.
After lawmakers hammer out their differences in conference, the bill will head for the president's desk. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We had what's called a flight to quality today as investors got tired of not knowing where the next bit of bad news on subprimes is going to come from. A good part of the money that left equities wound up in government bonds. Prices there rose, and when that happens, yields or interest rates fall. Gold hit a 10-week high, didn't do the dollar any good, though. Fresh record lows against the euro. We'll have the details the whole week on Wall Street and the stockbroker from Dallas when we do the numbers. I'd say it's a pretty good week to be in the book business if you happen to have a stock of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows back in your warehouse. Not such a good week, though, if you've got a book coming out and your name's not J.K. Rowling. Once upon a time, publishers would go the extra mile to help out their writers. These days, though, authors shouldn't really expect much. Sally Herships reports the book party, which used to be a staple of the publishing industry, has largely vanished.
Taylor Antrim is a first-time novelist. He wrote his book, The Headmaster Ritual, almost 3 years ago. It was finally published last week. He's excited, but there is one problem.
It does happen to be the month that Harry Potter is dropping on us.
Antrim says July is a tough month for books. Magazines are skinnier, which means less advertising and fewer book reviews.
And then when you add to that the fact that just the biggest book, you know, in the world is coming out in July, it casts a pretty big shadow.
The marketing machine behind the new Harry Potter book is intimidating. If this were the 80s or the 90s, Antrim's publisher might have thrown him a party to generate some counterbuzz. Paul Bogards works for the publishing house Knopf. He says book parties aren't popular these days, and for good reason.
There isn't any conclusive evidence to suggest that a book party results in book sales. If they were, we'd be spending a lot more on canapés and hors d'oeuvres, trust me.
Bogart says publishers are still feeding people on their dime, but less of them. Instead of throwing parties, publishers are holding intimate dinners for press, authors, and store owners. They think they're getting better chemistry for a lower price.
You want that special spark to take hold. And if it does, I mean, a bookseller will walk away from an event like that and say, you know, I met so-and-so, and they told me the story about their book. And, well, and that's how a book comes to life.
Charlotte Abbott is a senior editor at Publishers Weekly. She says today's publishers spend more on getting books into the market than on parties.
Because no matter how much someone's heard about a book, if they can't find it in the stores, it's kind of a non-starter.
Antrim knew his publisher wasn't planning a bash, so he was left waiting like a debutante for someone else to offer to throw a party for him, which is exactly what happened. His cousin Caroline Milbank has a very nice apartment in Manhattan.
A few weeks ago, I got a nice email from her saying, oh my gosh, we would love to throw a book party for you. Please tell me no one has offered yet. And of course, no one had offered yet.
We're both writers. It's so fun to have him publish a book.
Caroline Milbank set the tab at the party for food, drinks, and people to pass them out came to about 2,000 bucks. Not bad when you hear Charlotte Abbott describe a book party for Bill Clinton.
That party had to cost like $60,000 or more, I would think. It was packed. And then also, I don't know who pays to put the red carpet out in front. You have to rent a red carpet.
Taylor Antrim didn't get a red carpet, of course. It's his first novel. But Abbott says Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling didn't get one either the first time round.
There's been this perception of all this hype, but it did not start out that way. It was really a kid's word-of-mouth thing.
Abbott says first-time authors can't count on the same kind of unprecedented underground success that carried Harry Potter. She says marketing and buzz are important and parties are nice, but first-time authors should focus on the people they meet in the book industry.
You can't afford not to make the best impression on them possible because the fate of your book is really in their hands.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks to Caroline and Jerry.
In other words, the book business is like any other. It's relationships that matter. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with that guy down in Dallas, Texas, our stockbroker, business analyst friend, Mr. David Johnson. David, how are you?
Kai Rizdahl, as I live and breathe, I'm doing great. It's another I told you so day. I told my colleagues, I said, you know, we've done a dandy job. Let's just call it quits and not trade on Friday. We'll call it a marvelous four-day week.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, a closing bell could not have come early enough for you this week, I imagine.
Yeah, we were down 200 points for a while, down 149 today. But, you know, after the Murdoch hit the new 14,000 mark, you like that?
I did, actually. That was very creative. I think we might use it.
It's probably, you know, it's going to happen. And he's got to brand everything. But anyway,
the News Corp Industrial Average?
Well, I'm thinking Murdoch, but maybe it'll be the News Corp. Yeah, we'll find out.
Anyway, so you were thinking.
So when the Murdoch hit 14,000 the other day, I said, you know, this just goes to show you this wall of worry that we keep climbing and it keeps working. I think it's still true, but I was going back. Indulge me for a minute. Wednesday, remember, was just
a.
That's a good point. Wednesday was just a horrible day on the market. I think we were down like 150 points. We closed out about 50. But I made these notes. Listen to this. There was a rumor that Lehman was going to join Bear Stearns and say that they'd lost a ton of money in the subprime market, and they didn't. But oil ended that day at an 11-month high. Bernanke had been on Capitol Hill, and he cut the growth numbers for the gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. Pulte came out and said they'd probably lose like $750 million or something for the quarter. I mean, it looked like the end of the world.
And yet, the following day, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. It's a bull market. And this is another example of a bull market. It's a bull market when every time the market sells off, it's seen as a buying opportunity. Everybody rushes in and loads the boat. And that's generally what's been happening. And today, I mean, we could even sort of excuse – there were a couple of troublesome things about today, but we'll get to it. But today you can sort of excuse some of it because, you know, Google just finally – somebody pointed out the emperor had no clothes on, and the stock fell $28. And Caterpillar Tractor, I don't know, closed down 3.75. I think it was down 7 at one point. But it accounted for a lot of the losses in the Dow.
Yeah, but hold on just a second here, because I don't know if you remember this, but 3 months ago, you and I had a conversation about Caterpillar, right? And it was on a day when Caterpillar had come out and said, domestic U.S. sales, really bad. International sales, really good. And that was a reason for the market to celebrate and go buying. And so now you're telling me that today, when it came out to say the same thing, that domestic sales not so good, international sales really good, it's taken the market down?
Just when you think you get it figured out, they change the rules on you. That's the thing, Kai. No, in this case, I think that's still true. I think that's very true. And I think we saw how important the international sales were to Coca-Cola and to McDonald's, mm-hmm. and even to what is it, Whirlpool today. And so I think this is an example of why this was sort of an excuse to sell it off today, and they're probably going to take it back up again when we resume trading on Monday.
On Monday. And we will be back next Friday. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
I bet they do call it the Murdoch, not the News Corp.
We'll figure it out. I don't know. Anyway, coming up, the delicate art of finding love for the lonely.
There are quite a lot of intricacies in this industry because you're dealing with people's emotions, you're dealing with people's feelings.
But first, let's do the numbers. The party was so over on Wall Street today. The Murdoch Industrials fell 149 points, more than 1%, to end trading at 13,851. The NASDAQ down 32 points, almost 1.2%, and closed at 2,687. The S&P 500 shed 18 points, nearly 1.25%, finishing at 1,534. So take your pick. It was either a week the Dow hit a new all-time high or one in which the blue chips actually slipped 0.4% since Monday. The NASDAQ pulled back by 0.7% for the week, while the broader S&P 500 lost 1.2% over the past 5 days. Caterpillar, that Johnson was mentioning, dug one of the biggest holes for the Dow today, down more than 4%. And never mind a quarterly jump in profits of 28% for Google. Investors were looking for something better. The stock slid more than 5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by American Public Media's weekly program, Speaking of Faith. Starting July 19th, Krista Tippett explores the ethics of eating with author Barbara Kingsolver, speakingoffaith.org. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. Sirius Satellite Radio CEO Mel Karmazin is at the National Press Club. He'll talk about the proposed merger with XM Satellite Radio. He stands to be the CEO of the combined company if they join forces. Got a question for one of the Democratic presidential hopefuls? Get your camera out and submit your video to YouTube. Together with CNN, they're sponsoring a debate where your question could be broadcast. And Oscar winner Philip Seymour Hoffman turns 40. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back. There are big changes coming to U.S. agriculture policy. The once every 5 years farm bill is up for debate in Congress this summer. $250 billion covering everything from public nutrition programs to biofuel. Oh, and subsidies to farmers, too. Last night, the House Agriculture Committee voted to end federal payments to the wealthiest farmers, net worth of $1 million or more. That's down from a cutoff of $2.5 million the last time around. The whole House takes up the bill next week, and commentator Stephen Moore says it's a step in the right direction, but only just a small one.
Thanks to the ethanol subsidy program, millions of acres of corn are being converted into fuel, and many Iowa and Nebraska corn farmers are seeing their profits soar. These days, farmers are no longer the dirt-poor workers we think about from Steinbeck's classic, The Grapes of Wrath. Official USDA figures show that today the average farmer has income one-third above the national average and a net wealth of just under $1 million, eight times that of the average American family. If we really wanted to promote economic fairness, the corn farmers should be writing checks to the taxpayers, not the other way around. Yet the richest 1 in 10 farmers get 75% of the taxpayer handouts. Former basketball star Scottie Pippen, and now a farm owner, gets a welfare check. Fortune 100 companies Exxon, Chevron, and Archer Daniels Midland get help too. What we have here is farm socialism. The government tells farmers what they will grow, on how many acres, and at what price. Farming is now arguably the most subsidized industry in America. Many farmers now receive about 30 cents of every dollar earned directly from Uncle Sam. Here's a better idea. Abolish handouts for multimillion-dollar agribusinesses and direct the aid to the farmers who temporarily need help. Senator Lugar of Indiana has proposed a plan to replace $20 billion a year in subsidies and instead create an insurance fund. That fund would dispense aid to farmers with incomes less than $200,000 if their incomes plunge due to bad weather or crop failure. Federal farm programs should be a safety net of last resort, not an annual entitlement check for the prosperous and politically powerful farm lobby. If we can push welfare mothers off the dole, certainly we should stop writing checks to Archer Daniels Midland and Scottie Pippen.
Stephen Moore is the senior economics writer for the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. You can write us yourselves if you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. On the face of it, you might not think the U.S. and Singapore have much in common at all. One's Asian, the other's not. One's a 25-square-mile city-state, the other one's not. One's a global economic powerhouse, the other's more of a service and finance economy. One thing they do have in common, though, is a falling birth rate. Rachel Louise Snyder reports Singapore has taken an unusual approach to pushing couples down the path of procreation.
We've all been there. 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. Your happy coupled friends are out enjoying their coupled lives, and there you are, a minute from donning your PJs and settling down with a bag of microwave popcorn. Terry's been there, too. He tells me about it at a local coffee shop.
I was alone at home, and every day I go back to an empty home.
Like many professionals, Terry didn't have much time to date or many chances to meet girls. Friends suggested he go out dancing.
I mean, it depends on individuals' choices. I'm not naturally inclined to clubbing.
He was, however, naturally inclined to movies. So when a friend told him about GoMovieDate.com, he was all over it.
The couples will actually meet inside the theater probably 15 minutes before their show, or we call it the icebreaker time.
That's Matthew Tam, the founder of GoMovieDate.com. It works like this. You sign up, pay a fee of $18 to $65 depending on your membership level, create a wish list of things you want in a date, and the computer sends you possible matches. Then you invite a match who gets your invite via text message. If he or she accepts, tickets are mailed to both parties with assigned seating.
Ours is like lifestyle dating. We feel that there's a growing market for it. Alone itself in Singapore, there are 700,000 singles out there. These people are actually willing to pay money to go for services like movies or lunch or drinks.
Matthew's not alone. The Singaporean government also sees a growing market, and they're willing to give seed money to startups or established dating services, all with the hope of hooking up.
In 2004, the low fertility rate of 1.24, I think that signaled that there was that there needs to be more measures to tackle the issue of falling birth rate.
That's Anna Goh, Deputy Director of Singapore's Social Development Unit. The SDU began in 1984 as a way for educated professionals to meet and marry. Since then, 47,000 members have married, and the SDU's created a slew of singles activities, from salsa dancing and speed dating to tea ceremonies and relationship counseling. What they didn't have was a dating industry.
Having the government play such a key role in providing such services for the past more than 20 years, we do see that the market has not fully developed in terms of the private sector.
So the SDU came up with the idea of accrediting dating services so people would know they were dealing with legitimate agencies and vetted clients. With an initial $650,000, they also funded burgeoning partnerships with dating services like GoMovieDate.com and Lunch Actually. Yvonne Lum is the founder of Lunch Actually. She says starting a dating business isn't just about having a phone and a computer in an office.
There are quite a lot of intricacies in this industry because you're dealing with people's emotions, you're dealing with people's feelings.
Yvonne says they meet with clients for an hour and won't sign anyone up unless they have potential matches. Then they reserve the table. All you have to do, Yvonne says, is show up and have fun. But one of the biggest challenges of having a dating service is that you're pretty much always working to get rid of your clients. Anna Goh calls it the churn.
The success of an organization or a dating agency is really about how well you match and how fast you match them. And it's not about retaining your clients like in most other business models.
As for Terry, well, he persevered through 30 movie dates. And then...
We met during the movie called This Date Movie. And after the movie, we hit it off instantly. And we got married officially 2nd of February this year.
For those of you wondering how he did it, he has this advice.
Cut out the crappy jokes and corny jokes.
In Singapore, this is Rachel Louise Snyder for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, there's that Potter book again. Kids have been lining up around the world to get their hands on Volume 7. And stories abound of fans trying to find advanced copies on the black market, which got the marketplace players thinking these books are addictive, really addictive.
Hey, mister, I need a fix real bad. You got some Potter?
Do I got some Potter? I got some serious Deathly Hallows right here, my man.
Hallows? What are you asking?
For valued customers like your bad self, $50.
$50? But that's 3 months of paper route money.
Perhaps you didn't hear me correctly, punk. This ain't no photocopy abridged action. This baby's uncut and open 0 times. Most Potterheads ain't even gonna see this deal until freaking midnight. You think I'm in the mood to bargain with your 10-year-old face?
Okay, be cool. Here's the money.
Aight. Now get out of here before your mama catches you out past your bedtime.
I got the first one as a gift from my mama.
Yeah, first one's always free, kid. First one's always free.
Rico Galliano and John Raby were the Marketplace players today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plummeted 149 points, more than 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 32 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 shuffled down 18 points. That's about 1.25% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, looking for the time and tutoring to fit in as a new American.
Immigrants work like crazy. Crazy. This schedule just doesn't work with what they have to do in their life. So, I mean, you can tell from her she wants to learn English, but we don't have anything to offer her.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.